Hello, and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, December 15th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with today's weather. Today will be cooler with a shower or two and a high of 41 degrees. Tonight will be on and off rain and drizzle with a low of 32 degrees. Saturday, there may be a bit of snow and rain with a high of 38 degrees. And now we turn to local and state news stories. Ruling disrupts lawsuit settlement. A voting rights suit was filed against Thurston County. Nick Heitrek reports from Omaha. A federal appeals court decision may have thrown a wrench in the works of a proposed settlement of a voting rights lawsuit filed by two Indian tribes and individual tribal members against Thurston County, a judge said in a new court filing. The Winnebago and Omaha tribes and the individuals last month reached an agreement with the county on a map with redrawn county board of supervisors districts that would give Native Americans a majority of voters in 5 of the 7 districts. All that remained was a judge's approval. Chief U.S. District Judge Robert Rossiter Jr. said he was inclined to accept the settlement, but a November ruling by the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, in which the court said Congress did not give private plaintiffs the ability to sue under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, could affect the proposed settlement. The tribe's lawsuit and the settlement rely heavily, but not exclusively, on Section 2, Rossiter said. In light of that groundbreaking ruling and the questions left open by that case, the court would like the parties to weigh in on the continued viability of their joint motion and the proposed consent decree in its current form, Rossiter wrote in an order filed Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Omaha. The judge asked both parties to file briefs by December 27th, and he would then decide after reviewing them if a hearing is needed. The tribes and 9 individuals sued Thurston County, the 7 county board members, and the county clerk in January, saying the current district map approved in 2022 violates the Voting Rights Act because it does not provide Native voters a fair chance to elect candidates of their choice in at least 4 of the districts. Natives make up 50.3% of the voting age population, compared with 43% of whites in Thurston County, which is home to both the Winnebago and Omaha Indian reservations. Because of their majority, the tribes said in the lawsuit, Natives should have a legitimate chance to elect representatives in at least 4 districts, but the current plan gives them a clear majority in only 3. Though Natives have a slight majority in 2 other districts, the lawsuit said, those districts were drawn purposely by non-Native board members to take advantage of traditional low Native voter turnout and ensure white politicians maintain control. The board currently has 2 Native and 5 white members. The county denied the discrimination claims and argued that the current map, which was drawn by an independent vendor, met Voting Rights Act requirements. On November 22nd, the tribes and county notified Rossiter they had reached a settlement and sought his approval. The settlement included redrawn districts both sides said comply with the Voting Rights Act. Under the redistricting, Natives would have a majority of voters, ranging from 94% to 53% in 5 districts. The plan does not displace any current supervisors from their districts. Once the settlement receives judicial approval and is adopted by the county, the new districts should be in place for the 2024 election. The lawsuit is the 3rd voting rights suit the tribes have filed against Thurston County. In 1978, the Justice Department sued the county over its at-large method of electing supervisors. A consent decree in that case resulted in the current 7-district format. A 2nd lawsuit stemmed from redistricting after the 1990 census that diluted Native voting strength by not creating a 3rd district in which Natives had an effective majority. Mobile County moving ahead with road project. Caitlin Yamada reports from Sioux City. The City of Mobile and the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors are moving forward with the frontage road improvement project. The Mobile City Council has asked the Board of Supervisors to contribute $399,150 for street improvements from 3rd Street through Fair Street. The board voted unanimously to proceed with the project. In June, Mobile City Council asked the Board of Supervisors for $665,000 for part of the improvement costs to Frontage Road. The board expressed interest in the project at the time and asked Mobile to return this month. Frontage Road is a 50-50 cost share between Woodbury County and the City of Mobile, starting at 2nd Street. So far, Mobile has invested $2 million into the stretch of frontage between 2nd Street and Fair Street, Mobile Mayor James Fisher said. The $399,150 is half of the estimated cost. On Tuesday, the Mobile City Council presented an updated plan for the project. The cost to the county has significantly reduced due to Mobile removing parts of the project, Fisher said, but many of the items have had price increases since the beginning of the year. New economic development on Frontage Road since 2016 includes a Dollar General, Jensen Funeral Home, Security National Bank, Countryman Financial Group, Lewis Family Drug, Movillette, and the future Mobile Area Medical Clinic, Fisher said. In front of Security National Bank, the City of Mobile has invested $589,737 for the street, sidewalks, storm sewers, inlets, etc., he said. The city is asking Woodbury County to help them continue the street improvements from 3rd Street to Fair Street. Supervisor Jeremy Taylor previously proposed using tax increment funding. County Budget Director Dennis Butler said he would like to proceed with that option in conjunction with the Elk Creek Road construction project. In November, Woodbury County was awarded the 2023 National Lifetime Pavement Recognition Award for Frontage Road. The award, given by the American Concrete Paving Association, recognized Frontage Road for showing remarkable longevity, durability, and resilience. County Engineer Mark Nara said Frontage Road is one of the oldest highways in the region at over 101 years old. It is one of a few highways of this era that remains in continuing service anywhere in the nation, he said in the board packet. Lawrence man pleads not guilty of animal neglect. From Spencer, Iowa. A Lawrence, Iowa cattle owner charged with failing to provide adequate feed and water to a herd of cattle and causing the death of two of them, has pleaded not guilty of animal neglect. Brent Zvuba, 39, entered his written plea Monday in Clay County District Court to one count of animal neglect, serious injury or death, a serious misdemeanor. Zvuba was arrested, by the way, that's spelled S-V-U-B-A, was arrested September 26th after the Clay County Sheriff's Office received a report of malnourished cattle in a pasture in rural Webb. An investigation determined two cattle had died from malnourishment and lack of water. The other cattle appeared gaunt and thin and had apparently gone an extended period of time without feed, according to court documents. The cattle were moved to another location where they could be returned to health. Beresford teen identified as fatal crash victim. From Beresford, South Dakota. South Dakota authorities have identified a Beresford teen as one of three people killed in a pickup truck crash early Saturday. Cadence Nygaard, 19, died in the crash, which was discovered around 5 a.m. 10 miles northwest of Beresford by authorities who were investigating a report of a vehicle stolen from a farm nearby. The Dodge Ram pickup had been traveling east on 291st Street when it left the road and went airborne over a driveway. The truck landed in a ditch and rolled. Nygaard was pronounced dead at the scene, along with Gerard Muller, 20, of Parker, South Dakota, and Colin Hlavek, 18, of Irene, South Dakota. A fourth occupant, Hayden Hall, 20, of Davis, South Dakota, fled the scene and was soon located. He was taken to a hospital for treatment of serious, non-life-threatening injuries. None of the occupants were wearing seatbelts, according to the South Dakota Department of Public Safety. The South Dakota Highway Patrol continues to investigate the crash. And finally, building a middle class. Report shows Winnebago economy advancing over past 30 years. Mason Doctor reports from Winnebago, Nebraska. Economic conditions on the Winnebago Reservation have shown marked improvement over the last three decades, according to a report released this week. Since 1990, the median income of Native Americans on the Winnebago Reservation grew by 78%, according to the study sponsored by Ho-Chunk Inc., the tribe's economic development arm. The number of middle-class households more than doubled during that period. The Winnebago tribe's secret sauce is setting up multiple institutions to drive the growth at every level of our community, Lance Morgan, CEO of Ho-Chunk Inc., told the Journal. We intentionally have developed a middle class on our reservation, he added. We are, in fact, building a middle class in really what was the poorest place in Nebraska. And this is nothing short of an economic miracle, and it's a testament to the Winnebago tribe exercising its rights to develop itself and its sovereignty. When the state and the federal government get out of our way, it gives us a chance to be successful. But the 80-page report, prepared by the Taylor Policy Group, an independent consultancy, showed that while indices of economic well-being have greatly improved on the Winnebago Reservation over the past 30 years, residents remain substantially poorer than the U.S. median. Still, in some areas, Winnebago has seen more positive trends than the state of Nebraska or the country as a whole. The rate of homeownership, for instance, increased nearly 5% on the reservation between 2000 and 2020. While the overall home ownership rate in the United States and in Nebraska fell. You could consider it a multi-front war against poverty and brain drain, Jonathan Taylor, the author of the study, told the Journal by phone. Among other findings in the report, between 1989 and 2020, Winnebago's percentage of persons living in poverty decreased from 43.9% to 30.6%. Despite the improvement, this is well above the U.S. average of 12.8% and Thurston County overall, which is at 21.2%. During that same time period, the inflation-adjusted median household income on the reservation rose from $32,700 to $58,200. This is lower than the U.S. median household income of $73,500, but the inflation-adjusted U.S. median income barely budged over that 31-year period, giving the reservation a significantly larger jump in median incomes by comparison. Between 1990 and 2020, the Winnebago unemployment rate declined from 20.4% to 15.5%. This was better than other Great Plains reservations in the aggregate, which declined from 29.6% to 17.4% unemployment, though it remained significantly higher than the U.S. median and each state of the tri-state area. Over that period, the reservation's labor force participation rate, the percentage of adults engaged in the workforce, rose from 57.9% to 62.1%. The overall U.S. labor force participation was 65.3% in 2020, a decline of about 2% compared to 1990, and Nebraska overall had a labor force participation rate of 69.3%, among the highest in the country. Female labor force participation on the reservation is particularly strong, going from 55.2% in 1990 to 63.8% in 2020. This is higher than the U.S. average of 58.6% and only 1% below Nebraska's overall female labor force participation. The Winnebago male labor force participation rate declined, though not by as great a percentage as in the United States overall during that time. The percentage of Winnebago homes that are owner-occupied advanced from 39.7% in 2000 to 44.5% in 2020. By comparison, the U.S. percentage of owner-occupied homes actually dropped during that period, from 66.2% to 64.4%. The percentage of owner-occupied homes in Nebraska dropped from 67.4% to 66.2%. The percentage of adults over 25 with a bachelor's degree or higher roughly quadrupled from 3.5% in 2000 to 14% in 2020. In the United States overall, 32.9% of adults have at least a bachelor's degree. Goosing the Winnebago economy is a tall order, as the report noted. every year that the Winnebago economy does not grow faster than Nebraska's or the United States, the faster it has to grow in the future to catch up. The challenge is to outpace some of the most dynamic economies on the planet. Meanwhile, the Winnebago economy is in a remote rural location. But with so many positive trends, it's possible that someday the tribe's residents could reach income parity with the state of Nebraska and the country, Morgan said. Within a decade, he said, there's no reason the tribe couldn't surpass the median household income of the surrounding states. The median income of the tribe started way behind, but we have grown at a rate much faster than the rest of the state and America, and I see no reason why we can't catch them in the next 10 years, Morgan said. The Winnebago tribe's fortunes have been tied in part to the fortunes of Ho-Chunk Inc., which was formed in 1994. In 2022, Ho-Chunk Inc. paid the tribe a more than $5 million dividend. Morgan credited the Winnevegas Casino near Sloan, Iowa, with kickstarting the Ho-Chunk's share of the prosperity. That's what funded Ho-Chunk Inc., and that's what led to the development of the government, which has spawned lots of other entities like the hospital and the college. So they're all related, right? Morgan said. Ho-Chunk Inc. is part of the story, is a big part of the story, but it's really a story about the tribe and its long-term decision-making. The Winnebago tribe's successes came in spite of headwinds and setbacks at the federal level. Relative per capita federal tribal spending has slumped since the 1970s, and a lot of the laws are designed to be repressive. And so the system really is hard for tribes to break out of, Morgan said. We still function in a dysfunctional and exploitative legal system. It's just that we've been structurally able to rise above it, with a little bit of luck thrown in there, too, he added. Employees of Ho-Chunk and the tribe's entities were quoted in the report expressing satisfaction with their jobs, saying that the tribal employers were more sensitive to their needs as individuals. Bosses are extra cool. Other places crack the whip. Ira Rave, the machine operator at Ho-Chunk's Rock River Manufacturing, was quoted as saying in the report. Here, there is more understanding. They are parents, too, and they understand when things come up. We're good to all of our employees, Morgan said. Ho-Chunk itself, generator of $382 million in revenues as of last year, makes the vast majority of its revenues from government contracting. Smaller slices of its revenues come from gaming, construction, and other lines. That's expected to change radically in the years to come. By 2027 or 2028, thanks to anticipated massive growth in Ho-Chunk's gambling revenues, the company could approach $1 billion in annual revenues, Morgan said. Ho-Chunk was instrumental in the legalization of casino gaming in Nebraska in 2020, and it's made major bets on casinos in Omaha and Lincoln. Ho-Chunk also owns the AutoCAD Park racetrack in South Sioux City, where a casino is expected someday. It means that we can design and implement our own destiny, Morgan said of the impact of the projected $1 billion annual revenues on the tribe. And we haven't been able to do that for hundreds of years. In a modern society, money is the driver and the power. And now we turn to national and world news. Defense bill authorized. Lawmakers depart D.C. without approving spending for Ukraine. From Washington. The House passed a defense policy bill Thursday that authorizes the biggest pay raise for troops in more than two decades, overcoming objections from some conservatives concerned the measure did not do enough to restrict the Pentagon's diversity initiatives, abortion travel policy, and gender-affirming health care for transgender service members. The $886 billion defense bill was approved by a vote of 310-118 and now goes to President Joe Biden after the Senate overwhelmingly passed it Wednesday. It is likely the last piece of major legislation Congress will consider before leaving for the holiday break. Lawmakers departed Washington on Thursday without a deal to pass wartime support for Ukraine, even as Biden's administration raced to negotiate with Senate Republicans who demand changes to U.S. border security policy in return. The Senate planned to come back next week in hopes of finalizing a deal to place new restrictions on asylum claims at the U.S. border and pass the $110 billion package of aid for Ukraine, Israel, and other national security needs. But the House showed no sign of returning to push the legislation through the full Congress. Thursday's spending bill represents about a 3% increase from its prior year. The bill serves as a blueprint for programs Congress will seek to fund through follow-up spending bills. Lawmakers have been negotiating a final defense policy bill for months after each chamber passed strikingly different versions in July. Some of the priorities championed by social conservatives were a no-go for Democrats. Negotiators dropped them from the final version to get it over the finish line. That did not go over well with some Republican lawmakers, though most voted for a bill that traditionally has broad bipartisan support. Most notably, the bill does not include language sought by House Republicans to restrict gender-affirming health care for transgender service members, and it does not block the Pentagon's abortion travel policy, which allows reimbursement for travel expenses when a service member has to go out of state for an abortion or other reproductive care. Republicans did win some concessions on diversity and inclusion training in the military. For example, the bill freezes hiring for such training until a full accounting of the programming and cost is completed and reported to Congress. Putin says Russia will not yield. Citizens protest in Kyiv to allocate more money toward military efforts. From Moscow. Emboldened by battlefield gains and flagging Western support for Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin said Thursday there will be no peace until Russia achieves its goals, which he says remain unchanged after nearly 2 years of fighting. It was Putin's first formal news conference that Western media were allowed to attend since the Kremlin sent troops into Ukraine in February 2022. The highly choreographed session, which lasted more than 4 hours, was more about spectacle than scrutiny. While using the show as an opportunity to reinforce his authority ahead of an election in March that he is all but certain to win, Putin also gave a few rare details on what Moscow calls its special military operation in Ukraine. He said a steady influx of volunteers means there is no need for a second wave of mobilization of reservists to fight in Ukraine, a move that was deeply unpopular. He said there are some 617,000 Russian soldiers there, including about 244,000 troops who were mobilized a year ago to fight alongside professional forces. "There will be peace when we will achieve our goals," Putin said, repeating a frequent Kremlin line, "Victory will be ours." Meanwhile, hundreds of protesters, angered by what they view as wasteful spending by municipal officials, gathered outside Kyiv City Hall on Thursday and demanded that the money should go to Ukraine's war against Russia instead of local projects. The Money for the Armed Forces of Ukraine civic group, which organized the protest, was formed in September by people concerned by what they term unnecessary and poorly timed spending by the Kyiv City Council. Protesters chanted, "It's better to buy drones than build a new park," and "The more money we spend on the army, the faster Ukraine will win this war." Street protests in Ukraine were rare after Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022, which brought regular bombardment of the capital. Recently, though, demonstrations gathered momentum, and Thursday's protest was the largest so far over municipal spending. Municipal graft was regarded as a deep problem in Kyiv before the war. Corruption allegations have dogged Ukraine as it has received billions of dollars of Western support for its war effort. Israeli Defense Minister, war will last months. U.S. security advisor meets with leaders to discuss a timetable. From Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel's defense minister said Thursday it will take months to destroy Hamas, predicting a drawn-out war even as his country and its top ally, the United States, face increasing international isolation and alarm over the devastation from the campaign in Gaza. Yoav Gallant's comments came as U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Israeli leaders to discuss a timetable for winding down major combat in Gaza. Israeli leaders repeated their determination to pursue the military assault until they crush the militant group for its October 7th attack. The exchange seemed to continue a dynamic the two allies have been locked in for weeks. President Joe Biden's administration has shown unease over Israel's failure to reduce civilian casualties and its plans for the future of Gaza. But the White House continues to offer wholehearted support for Israel with weapons shipments and diplomatic backing. "I want them to be focused on how to save civilian lives," Biden said Thursday when asked if he wants Israel to scale down its operations by the end of the month. "Not stop going after Hamas, but be more careful." Appeals court upholds Trump gag order again. The former president wants to complain about court employees. From New York. A New York appeals court has again upheld a gag order that bars Donald Trump from commenting about court personnel in his civil fraud trial, ruling Thursday that the former president's lawyers used the wrong legal mechanism to fight the restriction. A four-judge panel in the state's mid-level appellate court ruled Thursday that Trump's lawyers erred by suing trial judge Arthur Engoron, who imposed the gag order in October after Trump disparaged his law clerk. Instead, the appellate judges wrote Trump's lawyers should have followed the normal appeals process by asking Engoron to reverse the order and then, if denied, fighting that decision in a higher court. The appeals court ruling came a day after testimony wrapped up in the 2.5-month trial. Closing arguments are scheduled for January 11th in the case. Engoron said he hopes to have a verdict by the end of January. Engoron imposed the gag order October 3rd after Trump, the leading contender for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, posted a derogatory comment about the judge's law clerk to social media. Older Americans to pay less for some drugs. From Washington. Hundreds of thousands of older Americans could pay less for some of their outpatient drug treatments beginning early next year, the Biden administration announced Thursday. The White House unveiled a list of 48 drugs, some of them injectables used to treat cancer, whose prices increased faster than the rate of inflation this year. Under the Inflation Reduction Act, drug makers will have to pay rebates to the federal government because of those price increases. The money will be used to lower the price Medicare enrollees pay on the drugs. For years, there's been no check on how high or how fast Big Pharma can raise drug prices, President Joe Biden said Thursday. "Let's call this for what it is. It simply is a ripoff. They're ripping off Medicare. They're ripping off the American people. We're now fighting back." EU leaders failed to agree on $55 billion in aid for Ukraine. From Brussels, European Union leaders failed to agree on a $55 billion aid package for Ukraine and on the renegotiation of the EU budget, EU Council President Charles Michel said late Thursday. The financial package could not be endorsed by all 27 leaders, who earlier Thursday agreed to open membership negotiations with Ukraine. The money is aimed at helping the war-torn country weather the Russian invasion. The EU decided earlier Thursday to open accession negotiations with Ukraine, a stunning reversal for a country at war that struggled to find the backing for its membership aspirations and long-faced obstinate opposition from Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, December 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now a few more national and world brief stories. Giuliani case. Jurors began deliberating Thursday to decide how much Rudy Giuliani must pay two former Georgia election workers for spreading lies about them that led to a barrage of racist threats and upended their lives. 2024 ballot. The Michigan Court of Appeals said Thursday it won't stop former President Donald Trump from appearing on the state's 2024 Republican primary ballot, rejecting challenges from critics who say his role in the 2021 Capitol attack disqualifies him under the Constitution's Insurrection Clause. Mortgage rates. The average long-term U.S. mortgage rate dropped below 7% to its lowest level since early August, mortgage buyer Freddie Mac said Thursday, another boost for prospective homebuyers. Santos seat. Republicans picked Nassau County lawmaker and former Israeli paratrooper Mazi Pilip as their candidate against Democratic ex-representative Tom Suozzi in a February 13th special election to replace ousted New York Congressman George Santos, party officials said Thursday. E-cig seizure. U.S. agents recently seized more than 1.4 million deliberately mislabeled and illegal e-cigarettes valued at $18 million from overseas manufacturers, including the Chinese company behind Elf Bar, Food and Drug Administration officials said Thursday. And finally, shooting plot. A 13-year-old Canton, Ohio boy was charged with allegedly posting plans for a mass shooting of a Jewish synagogue on the online platform Discord, court documents released Thursday show. And now we turn to sports stories, starting with the NFL. Watt will play against Colts. From Pittsburgh. A few days in concussion protocol did not slow down T.J. Watt. The Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker says he feels great and expects to play on Saturday when the Steelers, who are at 7-6, visit Indianapolis, also at 7-6. Watt reported concussion-like symptoms last Friday, the day after taking a knee to the face mask from New England running back Ezekiel Elliott on the first play of what became a 21-18 loss to the Patriots. He left for a brief period before being given the okay to play. The perennial All-Pro said he had stuff going on when he reported to the team facility the next day. He returned to practice on Tuesday and was cleared by an independent neurologist Wednesday night. Watt, whose 14 sacks are second in the NFL, added a tinted visor to his helmet for the majority of the New England game. He declined to get into specifics about the decision, pointing out that he's worn a visor during pregame and during practice, adding that it's not something that's new for me. Watt also laughed when asked about the tests he underwent before getting cleared to return against New England. "We can break down every little thing that I do," he said. "I think it's funny how things get caught on camera when you could do things other times that aren't on camera. So I'm not going to get in all the specifics and into a debate about it. I'm focused on this week and the Colts." Vikings Madison O'Neal out. Jefferson questionable. The Minnesota Vikings have ruled running back Alexander Madison and right tackle Brian O'Neal out of their upcoming game at Cincinnati because of ankle sprains. Wide receiver Justin Jefferson was listed as questionable Thursday on the final injury report of the week, with a bruised chest that forced him out of the previous game. Jefferson said he plans to play Saturday against the Bengals. David Kessenberry took over for O'Neal when the injury sidelined him last week in the 3-0 victory at Las Vegas. Madison was also forced out of the game, putting Ty Chandler in the lead role in the backfield and moving Kenny Nwangru into the mix for carries. Right guard Ed Ingram will return to the lineup after a hip injury held him out against the Raiders. League making more progress in diversity hiring. The National Football League continues to make incremental, widespread progress in its diversity hiring practices, according to an annual report. Thursday's report card from the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport at Central Florida gave the NFL an overall grade of B+, which is the highest mark for the league since the study began in 1988. The league received a B- mark for racial hiring and a B for gender hiring. Among the highlights, there were 9 general managers who were people of color at the start of the 2023 season, 30% of the league. Also, the overall percentage of people of color who have an NFL assistant coaching position rose to 43.6%, which is up from last year and has improved from 31.8% in 2013, which earned an A+ grade. Flacco signs deal with Browns. Joe Flacco's officially signed and sealed with Cleveland. He's already delivered. Flacco got a 1-year, $4.05 million contract, loaded with incentives, on Thursday from the Browns, who brought in the veteran quarterback last month while in emergency mode after losing starter Deshaun Watson for the season with a right shoulder injury. The team elevated Flacco from the practice squad in each of the past 2 weeks to start games against the Rams and Jaguars. Prescott, Crosby, Mack, among Rooney Award finalists. Dallas Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott, Los Angeles Chargers three-time All-Pro edge rusher Khalil Mack, and Las Vegas Raiders two-time Pro Bowl edge rusher Max Crosby are among the 8 finalists for the 9th annual Art Rooney Sportsmanship Award. Each NFL team nominated one of its players for the award, which recognizes those who exemplify outstanding sportsmanship on the field. The other finalists announced Thursday are New York Jets linebacker C.J. Mosley, Baltimore Ravens guard Kevin Zeitler, Arizona Cardinals safety Budda Baker, San Francisco 49ers fullback Kyle Juszczyk, and Seattle Seahawks linebacker Bobby Wagner. Packers Jones has broken thumb. From Green Bay, Wisconsin, Packers running back A.J. Dillon has a broken right thumb, and it's not clear whether he'll play Sunday against Tampa Bay. We're just taking it day by day, just trying to see how I'm feeling as it's going and stuff like that moving forward, Dillon said Thursday. The injury occurred during the Packers' final drive in their 24-22 loss to the New York Giants on Monday night. Jaguars. A 31-year-old former Jacksonville Jaguars financial manager accused of stealing more than $22 million from the NFL franchise through its virtual credit card program pleaded guilty to federal charges Thursday and faces up to 30 years in prison. Jones. Former NFL player Adam Pac-Man Jones reached a plea agreement on a disorderly conduct charge Thursday after he was removed from a plane before takeoff at the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport in September. Jones was sentenced to 30 days in jail as part of the deal, but that time is suspended as long as he has no unlawful conduct at the airport for 2 years, according to media reports. And finally, honors. Emmy Award-winning actor, writer, and producer Keegan-Michael Key will host the NFL Honors Show on February 8th when the Associated Press Individual Awards are announced. The primetime honors special will air live from Resorts World Theater in Las Vegas. In NBA basketball, double-double by Tatum lifts Celtics to 12-0 at home. From Boston, Jason Tatum scored 27 points, Jaylen Brown had 22, and the Boston Celtics beat the Cleveland Cavaliers 116-107 on Thursday night to improve to 12-0 at home. Facing the Cavaliers for the second consecutive game at TD Garden after a victory on Tuesday, Boston won for the 6th time in 7 games overall. Kristaps Porzingis added 18 points. Drew Holiday had 15, and Derek White 14 for the Celtics, who have the best record in the Eastern Conference. Tatum added 11 rebounds, and all 5 starters scored in double figures. Donovan Mitchell paced Cleveland with 31 points. Caris LeVert finished with 26, and Darius Garland had 19 for the Cavaliers, who have lost 3 straight. Timberwolves 119, Mavericks 101. Naz Reid scored 19 of his season-high 27 points in the first half. Karl Anthony Towns had 21 points and a season-high 17 rebounds, and Minnesota shook off an early 15-point deficit to beat host Dallas. Luka Doncic had 39 points and 13 rebounds for the Mavericks, whose 4-game winning streak ended. Bulls 124, Heat 116. Kobe White scored 26 points. Ayo Dosunmu scored 24 off the Chicago bench, and the Bulls ran out to a huge lead before hanging on to win at Miami. Nikola Vucevic finished with 24 points, 12 rebounds, and 7 assists for the Bulls. White had 11 assists and 7 rebounds, while DeMar DeRozan scored 23 for Chicago. Nuggets 124, Nets 101. Nikola Jokic became the first NBA player with at least 10 triple-doubles in 7 straight seasons, as host Denver beat Brooklyn for its 3rd consecutive win. Jokic I'm sorry, J-O-K-I-C, had 26 points, 15 rebounds, and 10 assists in his 115th career triple-double during the regular season. Jazz 122, Trailblazers 114. Colin Sexton scored 27 points, Simone Fontecchio had 24, and Utah won at Portland. Talen Horton-Tucker added 23 points for the shorthanded Jazz, who were without all-star forward Lauri Markkanen, as well as John Collins, Jordan Clarkson, and Keontae George. Clippers 120, Warriors 113. James Harden had 28 points, Kawhi Leonard scored 27, and host Los Angeles defeated Golden State for their sixth straight win. In other NBA news, Bucks Pacers tussle over milestone ball. From Milwaukee, Giannis Antetokounmpo exchanged heated words with members of the Indiana staff and raced toward the Pacers' locker room Wednesday night as the team squared off in a hallway in a dispute over the game ball following his franchise record 64-point performance. After the Bucks' 140-126 victory, Antetokounmpo had an animated discussion with Indiana star Tyrese Halliburton and other Pacers before rushing from the court toward the Indiana locker room in search of the ball. The Bucks wanted the game ball for Antetokounmpo. Indiana coach Rick Carlisle said the Pacers took the ball for Oscar Tshiebwe, who scored his first official NBA point. That led to a confrontation between members of the teams in the arena hallway. Afterward, there still was confusion over who had which game ball. One video appears to show the actual game ball being collected by a member of the Bucks staff. Carlisle said the Pacers apparently have a reserve game ball they took after the game. Bucks guard Cameron Payne said he was one of the players who went down the tunnel. Warriors. Golden State believes Draymond Green needs help to curb his history of rough play, and general manager Mike Dunleavy Jr. is hopeful an indefinite suspension provides enough time for their star forward to make real progress. And finally, one obituary. George McGinnis, a Hall of Fame forward who has a two-time ABA champion and three-time All-Star in the NBA and ABA, died Thursday. He was 73. Now we turn to National Hockey League news. Brink scores winner for surging Flyers. From Philadelphia. Bobby Brink scored the deciding goal in the shootout and also tallied one in regulation to lift the Philadelphia Flyers to a 4-3 victory over the Washington Capitals on Thursday night. Sean Couturier also scored in the shootout for the Flyers, who have won 5 of 6 and extended their point streak to 7 consecutive contests. Owen Tippett and Joel Farabee scored in regulation for Philadelphia. Brink came from a sharp angle in the shootout, then decked past Capitals goalie Charlie Lindgren before the easy finish into the empty net. Dylan Strom and Tom Wilson each had a goal and an assist, and Connor McMichael also scored in regulation for the Capitals. Blue Jackets 6, Maple Leafs 5 in overtime. Kent Johnson scored his second goal of the game at 3 minutes and 26 seconds of overtime to give Columbus a road victory over Toronto after the Maple Leafs overcame a 5-goal deficit in the third period. Patrick Lane, Justin Danforth, Yegor Chinnikov, and Johnny Gaudreau also scored for Columbus, and Elvis Merzlikins gave 43 saves. Austin Matthews scored Toronto's final 2 goals to break a tie for the NHL lead with 23. Hurricanes 2, Red Wings 1. Jordan Staal broke a tie midway through the second as Carolina won at Detroit. Jack Drury also scored for Carolina, and Pyotr Kochetkov made 25 saves. Blues 4, Senators 2. Robert Thomas had 2 goals and an assist as host St. Louis won in interim coach Drew Bannister's NHL coaching debut, ending a 4-game skid. Wild 3, Flames 2. In a shootout. Matt Zuccarello and Matt Boldy scored in the shootout to lift host Minnesota over Calgary. Boldy and Marco Rossi scored in regulation for Minnesota, and Philip Gustafsson stopped 36 shots. Lightning 7, Oilers 4. Steven Stamkos scored 4 goals, Andrei Vasilevsky made 53 saves, and Tampa Bay ended host Edmonton's winning streak at 8. Kraken 7, Blackhawks 1. Kaylor Yamamoto scored twice in the first period. Oliver Bjorkstrand had a goal and 2 assists, and host Seattle shut down rookie sensation Connor Bedard and Chicago. Canucks 4, Panthers nothing. Thatcher Demko stopped all 36 shots he faced for host Vancouver, which pushed its winning streak to 4 by beating Florida. In other hockey news, Hedman misses second straight game. Tampa Bay Lightning defenseman Victor Hedman missed a second straight game Thursday in Edmonton, but Tampa Bay could be getting a key player back from injury. Hedman, who leads the team in average ice time, had played in every game this season before missing Tuesday's loss in Vancouver with an upper body injury. He did not return for the third period of Saturday's overtime win in Seattle. He was out Thursday when the Lightning played the Oilers at Rogers Place, head coach John Cooper said during the team's optional morning skate in Edmonton. Also on Thursday, the Lightning made several roster moves aimed at bringing forward Connor Sheary back from long-term injured reserve. Sheary has missed the past month with a left-hand injury. Missing wings. Detroit played without its top 2 centers Thursday, Dylan Larkin and JT Compher, who are on injured reserve. David Perrin served the 3rd game of his 6-game league suspension for cross-checking Ottawa's Artem Zub. And finally, Wild. Minnesota recently concluded 2 investigations into its code of conduct, and the organization said Thursday night it took appropriate steps to address the matters that were brought to its attention. And one stat of the day, 800. Colorado's Nathan MacKinnon had 2 assists in Wednesday's 5-1 victory over the Buffalo Sabres to reach 800 career points. MacKinnon became the 5th player in franchise history to reach the 800-point mark. And now a few off-season stories from Major League Baseball. Ohtani dodges Tommy John questions. From Los Angeles, Shohei Ohtani opened his first news conference with the Los Angeles Dodgers by dodging questions about whether he had a second Tommy John surgery. "It was a procedure. I'm not sure what it was called," Ohtani said Thursday. Speaking to media for the first time since August 9th, he also refused to say what other teams he negotiated with before the agreement last weekend on a record $700 million contract. "I just can't wait to join the team and get it going," he said. Ohtani wore a navy business suit with a white shirt and blue tie, took off the jacket and put on a Dodgers home jersey with number 17, and then the blue cap with the interlocking L&A. He took off the cap before speaking. He was impressed when Dodgers officials told them they considered the last decade a failure because the team won only 1 World Series title. An electronic sign flashed, "Welcome to the Dodgers, Shohei Ohtani," in English and Japanese above the stage. Ohtani thanked Walter, team president Stan Kasten, Friedman, general manager Brandon Gomez, and manager Dave Roberts. Dodgers swing big deal with Rays. Not long after Ohtani wrapped up his press conference, the Dodgers were back on the phones to continue adding to their team. Los Angeles acquired starting pitcher Tyler Glasnow and center fielder Manuel Margot from the Tampa Bay Rays on Thursday night, ESPN's Jeff Passan reported. The Rays will receive Ryan Pepiot and Johnny DeLuca. Passan noted the deal is contingent on Glasnow signing an extension with the Dodgers, something he's expected to do. Glasnow, 30, spent the last 6 seasons with Tampa Bay. He finished 2023 going 10-7 with a 3.53 ERA in 21 starts. Also Thursday, Dodgers pitcher Clayton Kershaw said he is recovering well after recent shoulder surgery and has yet to decide where and when to sign his next contract. Brewers acquire Clark from KC. Right-hander Taylor Clark was acquired by the Milwaukee Brewers from the Kansas City Royals on Thursday for minor league pitcher Ryan Brady and infielder Cam Devaney. Clark, 30, went 3-6 with a 5.95 ERA last season in 56 relief appearances and two starts. He struck out 65 and walked 24 in 59 innings. Also on Thursday, the Royals finalized their $45 million, three-year contract with right-hander Seth Lugo. Lugo gets $15 million in each season and can terminate the deal after 2 years and $30 million. Lopez Mets finalized contract. Relief pitcher Jorge Lopez and the New York Mets finalized their $2 million, one-year contract on Thursday. Lopez gives the Mets another experienced arm as they rebuild their bullpen depth with low-cost cast-offs. The right-hander pitched for three playoff teams last season, going 6-2 with a 5.95 ERA and three saves in 61 relief appearances for Minnesota, Miami, and Baltimore. And this obituary, Ken McKenzie, a left-handed reliever who was the only pitcher with a winning record on the expansion 1962 New York Mets, died Thursday. He was 89. And in news from the Texas Rangers, Texas signed free agent pitcher Tyler Mahle to a $22 million two-year contract, with the right-hander expected to miss the start of the 2024 season coming off Tommy John elbow surgery. Finally, these stories in college basketball. Number 7 Marquette denies upset bid of St. Thomas. From Milwaukee, Oso Igodoro scored 21 points, Tyler Kolek had 12 points and 10 assists, and number 7 Marquette hung on to beat St. Thomas, Minnesota, 84-79 on Thursday night in the Golden Eagles' final game before opening Big East competition. Kolek went 6 of 6 on free throws over the final 1 minute and 3 seconds to seal the victory. One night after UNLV upset number 8 Creighton and Chicago State shocked number 25 Northwestern, Marquette, which is at 9-2, got all it could handle from a Summit League program in its third season in Division I. The Golden Eagles, who were a 25.5-point favorite according to FanDuel Sportsbook, led it by 1 point with 3 minutes left, and the Tommies, who were at 6-5, kept it competitive until the final seconds. Drake Dobbs scored 14 points, Kendall Blue 13, Ben Now 12, Carter Bjerke 11, and Parker Bjorklund 10 for St. Thomas. Cam Jones had 13 points, Chase Ross 11, and David Joplin 10 for Marquette. And finally, number 23 Wisconsin 75, Jacksonville State 60. Stephen Kroll had 19 points and 9 rebounds. Tyler Wall added 16 points, and Wisconsin beat Jacksonville State in Madison. Wall scored the first 8 points for the Badgers, who were at 8-3, who bounced back from a lackluster performance in Saturday's 98-73 loss at number 1, Arizona. And that does it for this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, December 15th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.